Yes, indeed. Just to remind you that Paul is going to be joining us. It's our last In the Garden with Paul for the season. So if you have any questions heading into autumn, winter, as it relates to your garden, your potting, your indoor plants, your winter window boxes, whatever it might be, any questions? Is it time to prune something or another? I don't know, but Paul does. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts, or call 074 91 25000. Lovely reaction to our conversation with Rachel and Amy there. A fantastic interview. Rachel, a coach, and Amy Meehan. That comes in from Robert. Patricia says, Rachel, thank you for sharing your story. Wishing all the choir good luck tomorrow. What a beautiful song and beautifully sung from the Crana crew in Buncrana. Anthony, beautiful song. Breach says, amazing song. The war, so inspired, a survivor. And John also, great interview, Rachel and Amy. Absolutely beautiful from a survivor, says another text here. A massive congratulations to Rachel and Amy. What a beautiful anthem that comes in from Emer. Greg, I'm a cancer survivor and I really love this song. I can identify with Rachel and how tough cancer treatment is. And I think it's a part of it too that that we do talk about from time to time here. But sometimes I think when a different type of story is portrayed, it kind of denies people their tougher experience, if that makes sense. It's tough for everyone, but you know what I mean. Brilliant, Amy Meehan and Rachel, a coach. You're fantastic. That comes in for Robert. Hi, Greg. Any idea why I can't listen to Highland through the website Listen Live function? It's just stopped working and I listen through Irish Radio Live. Just wondered. I haven't a clue what's going on there. Let me see. I'm going to open it up here whilst we're live on the radio. Wouldn't that be funny? Listening to ourselves, there'll be a delay. I don't know. I have not come across that problem. Have you tried, if you've got a, maybe you've bookmarked the page, have you tried maybe refreshing it or deleting cookies or something?
Emily not is there. Back.
That's it playing there, I believe, on Highland Radio Listen Live. I don't know what the story is. Leave it with me. That's an ad that's running there at the moment. I'll see if it continues playing after that, because we want you to be able to listen if you can, particularly directly from the website. I wanted to change my hospital appointment as I was unwell. On the letter, it states to call the department should you wish to change or cancel an appointment. I rang 3 days in a row and my call would automatically be declined. It seemed that someone would pick up and hang up. I had the brainstorm to ring the main reception of the hospital and was transferred automatically. I was so annoyed by this. A tip and warning for those in a similar situation needing to change appointments. Let's see, is it live? Rang 3 days and
there I am.
My call would automatically be declined. It seemed that...
All right, well, it's Listening Live is working on the website at the moment. So if it's a bookmark, maybe resave it. It could be that.
Hi, Greg. Will you, on behalf of the people of Buncrana, ask our local and national representatives what's happening in relation to the swimming pool in Buncrana? This has been going on for years now, and there's a complete silence on the matter. Generations have passed through school without swimming lessons. It is something we've covered here. I can't remember the exact up-to-date situation. I believe it's budgeted for. I believe it's budgeted for in the council's budget, and plans are afoot. But I'll double check that and get that information for you. How's that? Let me see. When was the last story we ran on that here in Highland? That'll come up for me in a second anyway. I'll get back to that. All right. Last story was in the 19th of February. Donegal County Council have passed a motion to extend the funding application for the Buncrana Shorefront Development to include funding for a new leisure centre. The ambition application is asking for a figure in the region of €20 million. Councillor Jack Morris says if this application gets over the line, it'll be a game changer for the area. So it seems that leisure centre stroke swimming pool is now being coupled with the Buncrana Shore development. What that means in terms of it progressing, I don't know. Back in November 2020, assurances have been given that funding for Buncrana Leisure Centre has been set aside in Donegal County Council's capital budget. So that was 2020. There was a ring fencing story then on that again in the 30th of November. And then by the 19th of February this year, it was being coupled with the Buncrana Shorefront development application. So I'm not sure if that's a forward step or a backward step, but that's the up-to-date position. If you search Buncrana Swimming Pool on our website, you will see it's extensively in coverage. There's dozens of stories on it.
There is no hope for young people. I've read that one. Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate it. I was at a bank using their ATM. I was shocked to see they had removed the screen above where you enter your PIN. When asked why this was removed, I was told it was due to wheelchair access, although I feel as though the machines are way too high anyway. So does that make much sense now? Our whole transactions can be displayed for everyone in the queue to see. No privacy. I'm extremely upset about that. Okay, I'm not really familiar with how all that might be the situation. So there was a screen above the pad and it's gone now. Right, okay. If anyone has any further information or could add any further to that, please do 086 60 25000. Hi, Greg. It is now past time, given the GRA gave the Garda Commissioner only a 1% vote of confidence and the Justice Minister has been staunchly defending the Commissioner, that both the Garda Commissioner and the Justice Minister both need to resign due to an overall lack of confidence so as to maintain some public integrity in the justice system. Well, except the GRA. He seems to have got message of good faith and goodwill from many. Okay, we're going to be talking history with Dr. Joe Kelly after this short break. Dr. Joe Kelly's going to be joining us shortly. I think he's setting up there, but we await his entrance to the room shortly. He's got something to do. He'll join us very shortly. Hi, Greg. A bus company's taking money off young and vulnerable at night from discos, not taking them the safe distance to their homes, but rather the driver telling them to get off the bus before their stop, some having to walk in the dark up to a mile and a half on unlit, dangerous country roads you'd hardly walk on during the day due to the danger, never mind at night. These young adults with no reflectors, some, I'm sure, could be in a vulnerable state with alcohol, never mind the vulnerable state of being on a dangerous road. Is it going to take a tragedy before this act is stopped? This has happened a few times, and last night, with three girls and two boys, the bus driver asked them to get off and walk. The girls complained. The driver turned around and said, "Sure, you'll be all right. You've a flat pair of shoes on you." Only the girl that was on the bus that night said her father was a guard. The driver took them up the road. Surely, if something happened to them, the driver of this bus would be responsible. Right, okay. It is the 9 till noon show here. Is Dr. Joe Kelly there? Are you there, Joe?
I am. I hear you. Do you hear me?
I do hear you, but I'm looking up your nose it's like you have your laptop upside down. I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't have my normal computer. I'm using somebody else's, so unfortunately, that might explain why the computer's
if you look down, is there a camera lying on the desk? What's going on?
I don't know what way the camera works. Yeah,
it's
okay. I think I'm looking at...
Yeah, it's okay for now. Come here. Right, it's Talking History now with Dr. Joe Kelly. And as you all know, we're living in a rapidly changing Ireland and the traditional formation of our society is changing culturally and will continue to do so, we're told, in decades before us as more migrants come to our shores. Recent years have seen an expansion of numbers seeking to come here. However, what is the historical perspective on Irish immigration? At some stage, people had to come here and populate the island in the first place. So what do we know of the origin of the people that came here first and begun what we have today as our own Irish ethnicity? Because the census is that it's just been there for eternity, but we were formed, of course. So, Dr. Kelly, what do we know about the first settlers on this island?
For scholars, so if it's an enigma for scholars, obviously it's an enigma for us, the ordinary people of this country. And so what are the origins of our country is very hard to explain. Archaeologists and others have maybe given us more a historical and factual-based version of it. But in the 11th century, Irish scribes tried to explain the origin of Ireland. Where did we come from? Who are we? What are we? And so in the 11th century, there was this wonderful book written. Now, it was written in prose and it was written in poetry as well. And it's in a number of different manuscripts. There's various versions of it, but its source is about the 11th century. And it was called Lór Gaoilge na hÉireann, loosely translated the Book of the Taking of Ireland or the Book of Invasions of Ireland. And it talks about six invasions of Ireland, prehistoric times. And it was an attempt to explain our origin and our cultural identity and where the Gael came from, where the Irish Celtic peoples came from. Now, it's a pseudo-historical book, manuscript. Obviously, prehistory is before written history, so we don't know who existed before prehistory, before written history, and so a lot of it is guesswork. But it would be some way historical. Correct insofar as maybe it ties in with the Bronze Age and with the, for example, the Dolmens and Newgrange, that kind of period of history. So in an attempt to explain the origins of Ireland, these scribes wrote this book, a wonderful book called Lore Gaul in the Here, in the Book of the Taking of Ireland, to explain her origin. And so that started really with Noah's granddaughter, Caesar, before the flood. And again, the idea behind that was to give authenticity to our ethnicity, insofar as we were rooted with the Bible, if you understand. So Noah's granddaughter came to Ireland before the flood with some people and three men, and the three men were to divide the land between them. Two of them died on landing here, and one of them, Fintan, he said, well, to hell with this, I'm not going to be hanging around here with all these women to try to keep them happy. So he turned into a salmon. And he survived the flood and would later come back corporally to tell the story of what happened. So that was the first invasion, so to speak, of Ireland. She supposedly landed in Cork. That is the Book of Invasions, yeah.
And do we get any mentions in the Northwest in these books or in that book?
Oh, yeah, there's quite a lot. Very, very perceptive, Greg. Yeah, there's quite a number of references, quite a lot, actually, of references to Donegal, Ballyshannon, Greinionalia, throughout the Book of Invasions. That Donegal was, so to speak, a very important location, and still is, obviously, you know, we'd have to say that. But, for example, the Partholonians were the people that came after Caesar, according to the manuscript, about 312 years after. And their leader was Partholonian, and he didn't live very long. But while he was here, himself and his tribe, he brought his wife Delignad, and they lived in the top of Loch Éireann there in Inishamer, you know, the island there in Ballyshannon. You probably know this better than mm-hmm. I. There in Ballyshannon, that's just where they set up their base in Ireland, the Partholonians. And while the Partholonian himself was away on excursions, sea exertions, his wife Delignad, she had an affair with this man called Topa. And when Partholonian arrived back, he discovered not only that he have an affair with his wife, but he also drank out of his cup. And that was just not acceptable. So he killed Topas and also killed his wife's dog. And this was the first judgment of Ireland, according to the manuscript, whereby the Brehon said, well, hold on a minute here. Yeah, you could be justified in killing the man in anger, but killing your wife's dog was not justifiable. So as a punishment, she was given the island there just in Ballyshannon, and she called it after the dog. Samer was the name of the dog, her dog, so she called it Inishamer. So that explains the history behind that famous island that's just there in Ballyshannon. So you ask, mm-hmm. was it connected to Donegal? Yes, and
quite
they
deeply.
Didn't live very long. The Partholonians died out, and they were then replaced by a third tribe called the Numidians. They arrived about 30 years after that to Ireland.
And how extensively, when we say they arrive here, so we have the Portolians and then the Midians, and we'll get into the Midians and the delightfully named, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Firbolgs. But the when we talk about their invasion or their arrival, how many are we talking? How broadly the island do they populate, or are they in pockets, or do they, what happens to the people that are already here, for an example? We might use the Numidians as an example.
Yeah, well, it depends how you look at it. You know, it would be seen that, you know, for example, when the Partholonians arrived, they started cutting down woodlands and clearing the plains of Ireland. And they started introducing farm husbandry and agriculture and things like that, and making Ireland hospitable for civilization. So according to the manuscript, there was nothing there before that. You understand? This
I
is
do.
Them trying to explain. It's very exact, and it fits into exact timelines. Obviously, we know realistically that wasn't the case. And surprisingly, it's a very maybe interesting point you're making. You know, up until about the late 1600s, many people believe this book to be factually correct.
Mm-hmm. Even though there are the obvious gaps, which I've just pointed out, like a simple question is not addressed.
That's my point. Yeah. So you mentioned the Numidians then arrive. And again, this was another tribe of people that tried to survive. And they were descendants again of Noah, Noah and the Ark. Again, given authenticity to their culture, so to speak, that we're connected in with the Bible. And then they didn't survive very long because there was a tribe of people that lived on Torry all the time called the Fomori. Balor later would become their king. They were kind of a very powerful tribe of people, but they weren't really human. And they would subdue people that would come to Ireland. And the story of the Fomori are always there throughout all these invasions until the second last invasion when the Tuatha De Danann kills the leader of the Fomori and puts an end to them. But the Numidians succumb to the Tuatha De Danann and they have to leave. They just can't survive with the efforts that are being forced on them by the Fomori from Torry, them, you know, having to pay tribute, having to give corn, have to give some of their children to them, things like that. So they try to rebel against them. They don't succeed. And so they leave. The Numidians leave Ireland, three brothers, and one of them actually goes to England. His name was Britain Mail. And they believe that's how England got its name, as in Britain.
But we're still from the Book of Invasions here, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let me ask you, at what point... And we still have more to talk about it, but at what point was this not seen as gospel, that people saw this as a tale? Or, I presume no one accepts it to be true now, do they, Joe? And at what point did people sort of start questioning, you know, someone turned into a salmon or was a descendant of Noah, and so on and so forth?
Yeah. Look, you see, you've got to understand, and we'll maybe talk about a little later on. But the point is, for example, the fairy culture. I mean, I would have known people that would have believed in the fairies. And this ties in with the Book of Invasion. So there was, see, modern civilization, maybe we don't often realize, Greg, that there was no electricity in Ireland, say, 70 years ago. And so darkness came in the evenings and there was a boogeyman and there was the other world out there. We take for granted that the knowledge we have now, but there was a lot of lack of knowledge or ignorance in that sense. And so it was easier for them to believe things like this in the fact that they weren't educated. They hadn't read, they hadn't understood these things.
But you know what, Joe, to some extent, we are probably naive in thinking we are not ignorant, that we know everything. You know what I mean? I wonder in 70 years' time, will they reflect on conversations that we're having and call us ignorant and uneducated in the wider scale of learning?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I always say is we know more about what we don't know than what we do know. There's so much that we do not know. And we're always thinking we can control things. And just take, for example, with the COVID, you know, that we could get a vaccine, that we have the human intellect to overcome everything. Now we're talking about AI and we realize that AI is far more powerful maybe than our own human capacity and our own intellect. So look, there's always knowledge and it's always progressing. And God knows how they look back at us in 100 years' time saying, God, what the things that we believed or the things that we understood and what we didn't understand. But one has to understand people from within the time they're in and living in, and things make sense for them. And maybe the point about the Book of Lord Gaula isn't so much its historical accuracy, which is very pseudo-historical, but it's the way that they thought and how they understood themselves. And maybe that's a conversation we need to bring into today, like a modern version of Lord Gaula and Éirinn. I don't know, the Book of Invasions or the Taking of Ireland. Who are we as Irish people? What does it mean to be Irish today? What makes me Irish? What makes somebody, for example, an immigrant that comes here and is naturalised, like they're Irish now? So that whole discussion is something that we need maybe to bring into the modern day, the Book of Invasions.
It's not
something belonging to the 11th century as such.
But before we write another, let's finish the last one. I want to talk of the fir bollocks.
Yeah, the fir bollocks. Well, bollock in the Irish is belly, and like bollockum tea, a mouthful of tea bollock. Now, we're not sure why they're called fir bollocks, but one may think it's because of the belly shape of their sails when they were being blown in the wind. Scholars argue that it's because they had a leather pouch that they used when they were in slavery to go up carrying clay and materials like that up a mountain, so that this leather pouch was something that they held at their belly, and therefore they got the name the fir bollocks. But B-O-L-G-S, not the B-O-L-L-O-C-K-S.
No, the fir horribly bollock. Anglicised word. Yes, I understand.
Yeah. But absolutely. And they came to Ireland. They were enslaved in the Numidians that left. They went to Greece and were enslaved there and returned to Ireland after the Midians, about 230 years as the Fir Bolgs, and they survived for a while. And they divided up the Ireland into the provinces that we know now, you know, the five provinces. We say Cuige in Irish for a province. Well, we only have four today, Ulster, Connacht, Munster and Leinster, but there used to be an old province of Meath. So that's the Cuige, that's the five, but that's no longer in existence. So they were the people that had done that, you know.
Okay. One other question, because this sort of book of invasions versus maybe what we know or what is contested is blowing my mind here. So the book of invasions did write of five provinces, and are they the provinces that we are in now? So did the Fir Bolgs create them, or is this still a version of events? So do we have an actual knowledge that contradicts the Book of Invasions?
Yeah, very perceptive. You see, the Book of Invasions does breach into historical times factually. And so maybe they're looking retrospectively that there was five provinces, and they were then retrospectively writing the story from the knowledge they knew then. But there were five provinces. I would doubt very much if it was they that created those five provinces as such. But historically, at some point, it had to happen. Mm-hmm. And at some point, they had to emerge. And so for just clinical historical exactness, it fitted into the storyline. So let's put it in here.
It was for continuity then. So they had to absorb factual. When I say factual, because I don't want to upset anyone who might believe still. But they had to say, well, we can't ignore what we know, so we're going to have to tie it into this tale.
Yes, and that's what they were doing. But it made sense. And as I said to you earlier on, it isn't necessary that it's all factual historically, but that the information itself is factual. There were five provinces, and where did they come from, and how were they formed? So this was their ability. They're trying to understand and comprehend and explain, you know, their understanding of Ireland as they saw it.
Okay.
A very different Ireland than to today. So then the second last tribe.
Tua Danann. Yeah. So what period in history are we told this is?
Yeah, well, really, this is just almost at the arrival of Christianity, not Christianity, sorry, the Celts to Ireland. Mm. So the Celts are being pushed up through Europe, and the Tua Danann arrive just before the Celts to Ireland. And there were a tribe of people, now whether it was the Tua Danann, that were here before the Celtic arrival as such. And if you look at, for example, the word Leon or Ludun, London, or Dún Luathaire, It's the movement of this tribe of the Tua Danann. Lu is the month of August, Lunasa, and he was their leader, Lu. And Leon comes from Ludum Dunum, Lu's fort. And they were pushed up through into England, which then became Lu Dún, Lu's fort, Lundun. And then they ended up in Donegal, and it became known as Dún Luathaire, which is London back to front, Lu Dún Lu. Dr. Brian Lacey has written quite extensively about this, believing that the last of that tribe of Lu, now whether they were the Tua Danann or not, the tribe of Lu survived in Donegal, northwest Donegal. But they were a very mystical, kind of more supernatural people, according to the Lord Gaula. And they brought four great gifts to Ireland. One of them actually being the Leofile, the Stone of Destiny, which was later stolen by the British under colonisation. And that stone actually is the stone that's under the coronation seat that Charles was sitting on when he was crowned recently. That belongs to the people of Ireland.
So the Tua Danann, they did not leave the land necessarily. Some would have it that they are, I don't know, in hibernation or what's the story there?
Yeah. Well, the Tua Danann were very magical, mystical, supernatural type of people. When the last tribe, the Milesians, now the Milesians would have come from Spain. This is the beginning of Celtic Ireland. When they arrived, the Tua Danann tried to prevent them by bringing down a fog. They had this great power of bringing down a fog, the Fae Fee that was called. But the Milesians eventually managed to arrive in Ireland. And they went to war with the two of the Dana, but eventually they said, look, we're not going to be killing each other. Let's come to an agreement. And the deal was that the two of the Dana would go to the underworld, that they would go underground. And thus, that's where her old, all her fairy culture folklore comes from. You know, William Allingham there in Ballyshannon, up an airy mountain, down a rushy glen, you dare go a-hunting for fairy. All that fairy folklore.
Yeah, you took me back to national school there.
Yeah, well, there you are.
Is there any suggestion they may return from the underworld to which they were banished or agreed to go?
Yes, it's mentioned that they'll come back to rescue Ireland when there comes a darkness in Ireland, when people are confused, when they won't know the difference between right and wrong.
Well, they mustn't be on the internet. Where are they? Come back to it, Adana. We need you now. The time has come.
Yeah, well, maybe it has. When you think of the modern times that we're living in, you know, maybe we could do with a bit of leadership and guidance. But the book talks about a darkness coming over Ireland at some stage, and that the two of the Dana would come from the underworld up into our normal physical world. If you ever watched the film Into the West, it's a fabulous film about two traveller boys. But this horse comes cheering the nog. And we all know the stories of Chir na n-og and things like that. But the white horse is a symbol of the other world. And the only way you get to the other world is on the white horse. Wow. So when you see a white horse in Irish stories, there's something connecting you to the other world. Mm. And it's a very, very powerful film if you watch that. So that's the two of the Dana.
So when we get to the Celts and the Milesians then, I mean, at what point are we bridging accepted, recognised history?
What you've talked about now, the arrival of the Celts and the Milesians, two of the Dana possibly, but certainly the arrival of the Milesians. Now, whether it was the Milesians or not, but this is the beginning of accurate historical evidence-based. But again, you've got to understand, when it's been written in the 11th century, they didn't have the archaeological knowledge and carbon dating and all that we have now. But it fits in very, very well with the real historical, because from then on in, the High Kings of Ireland continue without break until the beginning of our colonisation and the arrival, say, of Henry II. Mm. So for to 1172, for all over 1,000 years, that line then becomes very clear. And the more we move from this period that's written in the Lord Gaula, it becomes actually more accurate, okay. The High Kings of Ireland. So the Malaysians come from Spain, but they went and they arrived to see the two of the Dana, and it was Grainan Alia, according to the Book of Invasions, that's in Grainan, and there in Burt, was one of the headquarters for the two of the Dana. So again, Donegal tied into the story. The Fomori, Torri were tied into the story. So the Book of Invasions refers to Donegal quite a lot.
So what was our race or ethnicity at that time then?
Well, it's the beginning of the Celts, the Gaels. And we believe that they were the ones then that brought the Irish language. And it was they that brought, you know, the Celtic culture, talking about the Bronze Age, advancements at that time. So this is the period then we're talking about. And the Malaysians, they had actually, again, in the Book of Invasions, it goes back to the time of the Tower of Babel, and where people were trying to build this temple to the sky, thinking that they could reach God and become infinite if they could reach there. Mm-hmm. And then God confused them by bringing 72 languages so they couldn't communicate with each other, mm-hmm. and therefore they weren't able to speak. And that became known as, you know, babbling on, you're babbling, you're making no sense. Well, that goes back to the whole story of the Tower of Babel. So this man, Farid Fawcett, who was living in Eastern Europe, Western Asia, he sent his son and other scholars to pick the best words from all the languages, and he called that language after his grandson, Gaelic, Gael, G-O-E-D-A-L-I-C, the Old Irish. And it was these Malaysians that brought this Gaelic to Ireland. So this is the origins then of our Irish language.
Were we era at that point?
Oh, very good. Era, you're... Era has a lot of different meanings, and we're not sure where it comes from, but you're hit the nail on the head. The two of the Dana had three lovely ladies, wives of the kings, Era, Banba, and Fodla. So when they met the Malaysians, they said, will you call Ireland after us? So supposedly they called it after Era, who was the most beautiful of them, Era, giving us Eru. Banba, I mean, we talked before about Banba's crown there, and then Sean is the top of Ireland. Banba is another old Irish name for Ireland. And then Fola. Fola is another name for Ireland. There's a place in England or in Scotland called Atoll. It's A Fola, a New Ireland. Irish people went to live in Scotland and they called it New Ireland. So Fola, Banba, and Eire are three names for Ireland. So yes, the Book of Invasions refer to the origins of that, but how accurate that is.
So we settled here, and maybe we're starting to see the formation of Ireland as we know it. But did that journey? I mean, did that journey conclude there, or did people pass through? If you know what I mean. So the original settlers, or however you might describe them here, did they stay here and that's from where we came, or did they continue their explanation or journey north, or where else did they land that is closely related perhaps to the origins of Eire as you've just outlined?
Well, the point is then when the Middle Ages came, these were the more modern, more versatile people having better knowledge of weaponry and tools and farm husbandry. So then they spread out throughout the whole of Ireland, and thus we explain who we are today. That whole, you know, homogenous idea of us being Irish, and that our whole roots and our Irishness goes back to the expansion of this tribe, these Malaysians, these Celts that came to Ireland, you know, over 2,000 years ago. And into the 11th century, that was explaining then who we were, and this is what we are. Mm. And so we became the Gael, okay. And the foreigner is the Gael, like Dunangal, the fort of the foreigner.
Joe,
and the
Gael... This conversation, again, we could do an hour, but I just want to remind ourselves of there come a time in our history that the famine, as it's called, our population has never recovered since. So how big, people left desperate, they left desperately. In what numbers are we talking, just to remind ourselves of that? Because a lot of people perished, a lot of people stayed, a lot of people left.
Well, in a short space of a decade, about a million people died. Well, a million people immediately died, roughly, and a million people emigrated. That's what historians would say. So consider that there was 8 million people in Ireland. So 1/8 of our population left, 1/8 of our population died. And that trend continued and has continued. So you're given the other side of the story there, Greg, which is, you know, the parameters of your understanding there, showing that while the Book of Invasions maybe explains the inward movement of people into our countries, you know, or into our country, when we look at, say, the famine, and if we go back to Columbkille and, say, for example, Columbanas and these Irish saints that left on their boats, there was over 70 Irish monasteries throughout the whole of Europe set up by Irish monks. You can't nearly go into a major European city without having an Irish manuscript.
But we left in our millions, so we can explain an initial 1 million. Sadly, a million died. The population didn't naturally shrivel to, what was it, 3.5 million not so long ago, or close on?
Yeah.
It was, wasn't it? I think when I was at school, the population was 3.5 million. So the 5 million, more people passed away, but primarily left this country than remained.
Yes.
That's remarkable. Absolutely. In our recent history, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if you look at America, they reckon there's 45 million Irish Americans alone, origins here. I mean, put that in relation to our present population. We were hitting, what is it, 5.7, 5.8 at the moment. We're heading for 10 million, it would appear. That's maybe the plan, if there is a plan. So there's a whole discussion about, first of all, as the Book of Invasions talk about the inward movement. And then we talked about the famine and, say, the monks and the outward movement of Irish people, which has always continued. And now here we are in a period in maybe this decade from the 2020s that, say, in the last, 15 years, there's over a million people, non-Irish residents, have come to this country, to our shores. I think I was just checking, 14% of the population of Ireland, which is over 700,000 people, have not been born in Ireland.
Mm. Not born in England, so, in that number as well, though, and Scotland, people have returned home.
Yeah. Oh, there's quite a number of that, or people that returned home that would maybe have Irish parents or whatever. Yeah. Quite a high number of that.
So they would be one of the biggest fears people have of people coming in to Ireland now is cultural change. Is that something that should be feared? A lot of people would like to pause history, but then you could reflect on really what is our culture when we choose not to speak our own language. But anyway, that's probably another conversation. But in a couple of minutes, what this is not propaganda, by the way. It's a general history conversation.
Yeah.
But looking at our history, should we be so fearful of the cultural change or the great replacement, as some people call it, that people believe it's part of a plan? I just think it's a lot of people that see a better life for themselves or have to flee where they are. But anyway, everyone has their own views. How scared should we be?
Well, again, I think that we need to have a conversation about how inward movement of people into our country, what effect that's having on us, both positive and negative. People are always afraid to talk about this because it's maybe talked either as just only negative or it's just talked about as only positive. And other countries have undergone mass inward movement of peoples as well. And there have been problems and also there have been benefits. And so, look, that's maybe a conversation for another day. But you're right in saying about the culture. The word Latin, in Latin for culture, cultere, you know, agriculture, to grow in the land. Cultere means to grow. And if we are, you know, we talk about inclusion and diversity. These are two buzzwords. Every politician will ever go on your show will throw in climate change, diversity and inclusion. They're the three buzzwords that they'll always throw into a conversation. But the question needs to be asked is, where is the room for the native Irish culture in inclusion, and where is the room in diversity for the native Irish culture, whatever that is? And then how do we, as a nation of people, because there are probably people that are Irish citizens that are naturalised, that are of different culture, how do we merge those cultures and how do we grow together and how do we get the most out of it?
Right. That is going to be a separate conversation because I have to go at the moment, Dr. Joe Kelly. Yeah. And as always, it just could rumble on and on because as soon as we finish, you throw in a doozy that we can't talk about because we don't have the time. Dr. Joe Kelly, we should talk again very shortly. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Back with gardening with Paul after these. All right, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. And we welcome into studio now Paul McLaughlin of Ballacdur Garden Centre. Paul, how are you getting on?
Not so bad, Greg. How are you?
I've got about 10 inches of grass that's never going to dry out. And I'm probably just going to...
Just enjoy it for what it is? Are you going to get the trimmer?
I don't think so.
Right. So it's been a rough time to try and get stuff.
So I'm probably just going to leave it.
Yeah. That's always good for nature.
Is it? Well, that's encouraging.
This time of year, I don't know exactly.
I appreciate it. Could you put that in writing so I can give it to Aisling? Right. Now, we're looking towards spring. We talked about this last week, so let's reiterate because we're sort of in the final throes now. But we can be planning.
Absolutely. Great time to the minute for bulbs, especially. Mm. As you see, every shop and every garden centre's full of them at the minute. After a long winter, and like it's been a bad enough year, so like a long, probably dreary winter, it's nice to get a bit of spring colour and have someone to look forward to. Mm. So now it's time to get your daffodils, tulips, alliums, that sort of stuff in.
Will weeds in the driveway die off in winter, or are they going to have to be killed?
Generally, weeds, they will die off a bit, but they'll not completely disappear. But new ones won't germinate over this period. So if you get them cleaned up, at least you have a good while to actually be free of them.
So, you know, your daffodils, your tulips, your snowdrops, you plant them now, they'll pop up, lovely bit of colour, welcome you into spring, and they're not terribly expensive. You're not talking about...
No, they're not expensive, and they're actually fairly foolproof to get to grow, actually, so they are. Once you just throw them in, follow the directions in the packet, and basically forget about them until they pop up in spring.
Now's the time to start tidying up your beds, do a bit of trimming, strimming.
Yes, generally give innings finished.
The growth is finished, kind of, so really anything you do now should hold for the winter.
Yeah, pretty much anything now. Generally give everything a wee trim, sort of innings finished flower, and give them a trim back, and just generally sort of give it a wee tidy. It actually makes the whole place look a lot better.
That's including roses, is it? Because we often get a lot of calls in, when's the time to trim back your roses?
Yeah, time to trim back your roses. Give them, once they're finished flowering now, sort of between sort of October, November, give them, say cut them back by maybe half, and then do the final trim of St. Patrick's Day, because the cut ends that you have generally get a bit battered over the winter.
Aye.
So if you cut them back to a clean thing in the spring, you have a much better growing.
Obviously, anything that's sitting on the ground, if you can raise it up a little bit, do.
Pretty much you get wee pot feet there to go in under your pots just to keep the drainage moving.
Yeah.
And if you can't find pot feet in the shop, that's just wee bits of board.
Yeah, because there's a consistent moisture there, isn't it?
That can just sit. And they can actually, if they're sitting in a puddle, it can actually suck up excess water from the puddle.
And again, just to remind people, you know, some people's summer flowers are still hanging on by the skin of their teeth, but they might want to switch them out for a bit of colour. over winter. That can be done now, and there are options there, aren't there? You don't necessarily have to just throw them in the shed and worry about them in the spring.
No, absolutely not. There are plenty of options to give you a wee bit of colour over the winter period there. Like your cyclamen, pansies, even heathers can be quite nice at this time of year.
So in terms of the lawn, I mentioned it, if you did finally get your last cut or you're planning on doing so, does, like, say things like leaves or other stuff that falls on it, do you leave that and it mulches and feeds the lawn, or do you need to get rid of that, or what's the story?
In our climate, I would tend to get rid of it. Give maybe over the course of the winter, give it a couple of rakes just to get the worst of the leaves off it, because that sort of increases moisture.
It's like a blanket too, isn't it?
Pretty much,
like
and a, just encourages moss, just in that sort of our mildish climate, damp climate.
Anything we can do from vegetable perspective, again, really popular, like things don't shut down completely just because it's winter. So from a vegetable perspective...
Vegetable perspective, now is the perfect time to get in, like your onions, your garlic, even peas, beans, and members of the cabbage family can all get in now. And while you probably won't have them this side of Christmas, if you get them in now, you'll have a good start in spring and you'll have a good early crop.
All right. So, daffodil bulbs, someone asks when, now.
No, perfect. Okay. Anytime between sort of September and December.
What about cutting back hydrangeas for the winter time?
Cutting back, debate about that. I would tend to cut them back now because it just tidies them up once the flowers are sort of spent on them. Other people would argue leave the old flowers on them to protect the crown of the plant from frost and cut them back in March. But to be honest, I've never seen frost over the winter doing them that much damage.
Yeah, I get
usually
you.
Early in the spring. So I would tend to give them a trim now.
A listener has a wedding in October. A lot of the flowers and colour is gone. They want something to zhuzh up the front door area as people arrive.
Take a look in your local garden centre. Like I say, the cyclamens, the pansies, all that's available now, so you could have sort of instant colour.
Why is my hedge suddenly turning brown? And should I be concerned?
Could be a multitude of reasons. Generally, if it's turning brown, yes, you probably should be concerned. Probably take photos, bring it into your garden centre, because there could be a lot of different plants involved, different types of plants. So,
does it matter if it's the top, the middle, or the bottom?
Generally, anything turning brown like that, I would worry about, especially if it's the likes of Lalandes, because if you think of a Christmas tree, it's sort of dead long before it starts turning brown.
I hear you. I have a Japanese anemones flower. It's it has a lot of seeds. How do I plant to grow as I want to gift it to friends?
Oh, that's a Japanese I can't even say it, anemone.
Yeah,
I think it is.
That's close enough.
Yeah, close enough. Japanese anemone from seeds generally is not the best idea. You're better actually taking from root division. You can actually dig the plant up, divide the root.
Right, okay.
Get it that way.
Better success rates.
A lot of them's hybridized, so the actual... the seed that comes off the plant may not be exactly the same, may not be exactly the same as the parent plant.
Interesting.
So it could be a different plant altogether, so it may not come out to be a true reflection on what you want to give.
Right. When do you cut back forest flames?
Forest flames, just, you can cut them back any time of the year, not early spring because you're going to cut off your nice sort of red foliage, but now would be a good enough time, just any time there's not frost imminent.
Is it too late to give the garden another cut? I presume it's the last one now, if you can get at it, right?
If you can get
you
at
want
it,
to leave a bit of length there, don't you?
To be honest, actually, you could still, theoretically, if you get a bit of mildness now, you maybe give another one a bit sort of mid-October.
And what people can't be talking about, you'll get little patches that probably grow a bit better than other areas, I think, don't you? I'm looking to source garden ready Polyanthus Crescendo mix. Any suggestions where I could source them, please?
We have Polyanthus down there, right, but they're not that particular variety. What we have is Husky and Alaska variety, which would be very similar. But the ones you mentioned there, they'd be sort of very vibrant colours. To get them garden ready, probably your local garden centre should have, they mayn't have that exact thing, but they'd have someone very close.
How do I get rid of ragweed? I've tried spraying it, but it keeps coming back. That comes in from Maurice.
Yes, the ragweed, it depends, there's a couple of... Ragweed sort of as a broad term refers to a few things. Probably the most common thing would be ragwort, which is what people right here would know as benweed. And generally they're the sort of tall yellow by you see in sort of grassland. Generally the best idea is to actually physically pull them.
Did the guards not used to have a role in policing that? Like guards would land to people and say, get that off your land.
Yeah, exactly, because they're very noxious to cows.
Yeah, so guards would actually call to people and enforce the cutting of...
Yes, exactly. So what you got, and it's very important, actually, if you do pull them, to put them somewhere away, because even as they dry out and as they're dead, they're still very poisonous to cows, and that's so don't put it anywhere near where animals may be.
Should we plant cover crops for the winter?
Plant cover crops for the winter? Yes, it's a good enough idea if you have vegetable beds of that. Cover crops are just a green manure. You plant them this time of year. They come up over the winter and then you just dig them in as a manure in the springtime.
And you keep wanting us to rake up our leaves. What do we do with them?
Leaf mould is actually a very good thing to do with them. Basically just make yourself if you have a big garden, make yourself an area at a palace and just put a pile of leaves in them and it'll very quickly turn to compost.
Lovely stuff. just finally, if you don't mind, about if someone wants to become a gardener, a qualified gardener, are there courses for it, or what's the pathway for that?
There are generally, pretty much if you're from secondary school, you can go straight on to degree courses. Generally, it's Waterford Institute of Technology or the Botanic Gardens in Dublin do it. Or sort of if you're older and sort of fancy it as a career, the likes of the ETB have very good courses. They're one starting next month. I think it's the end of next month in Letterkenny here.
Yeah.
It's level 5.
Okay.
And so it'd be worth chatting to them because, to be honest, there's a huge shortage of gardeners.
Really?
Qualified gardeners in Ireland and England.
Is that people that work on gardens?
People work in gardens, but even people that run, like, say, your big stately homes.
Yes.
That's
okay,
so there'd be very good careers in that in terms of government jobs and stuff. That's,
right.
And there's the statistics, there's something like 70% of head gardeners are over 60.
Wowzers.
So they're all going to be retired in a few years.
There you go. If you like the outdoors, you like colour, you like smell, you like creation, and you can really let your creative juices go, why not consider a degree course if you're older at the ETB or after school in the other places that are available? Interesting. We might talk before the winter's out. Who's to say? We might get a 3-week.
Yes, maybe.
We'll have to chat. But Paul, thanks for everything over the spring, summer. And we look forward to speaking to you really soon. It's only just around the corner. But for now, Paul McLaughlin, gardener at Bannockburn Garden Centre. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks again to Paul. And thanks to all of you who listened to the show today and took part in it, text in, called, however you communicated with us, the emailers. Thanks to all of the family on our social media as well, watching the show and commenting. It's always great to have you on board as well. We're back tomorrow morning at 9 with our Friday panel. So we have 3 guests in discussing some of the big topics of the day and the week. So please stay tuned for that, or tune in for that. And we also have That's Entertainment tomorrow between 11 and 12. We're going to be looking for your compliments. It's National Compliment Day tomorrow. So we're all going to be really nice to each other. But for me, Greg Hughes and the team of Caroline Orr, who researched and produced, and Niamh on social media, have a lovely day. And we'll chat to you, as I say, tomorrow morning from 9.